Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Following On, just 4 days to go until the third test match gets underway between India and England. The TalkSport 2 team bringing you all the action live and exclusively from, unfortunately, our studios in London Bridge, because of course, COVID times that we live in, we can't get out to India. And it made us think in the TalkSport Towers about some of the tales from our tours gone by. You've heard the watch-alongs in Sri Lanka and also South Africa. We will be recording a West Indies version as well. But it also brought to mind some of the tall tales that must have taken place from tours gone by. So, for today's show, we're bringing you part one of a conversation between the former England bowler Steve Harmison, the Sun's long-time cricket correspondent, harking back to about 1989, I think, John Etheridge, and the former Mail on Sunday cricket correspondent and cricket paper journalist Peter Hayter, who got together a few weeks before the start of the India-England series just to remind each other of some of the tales from tour life gone by. Second part of this interview will be released tomorrow morning on the Following On podcast feed. But for now, sit back and listen to some of the stories from years gone by as the guys go on the road again.
I guess, gentlemen, where did it all start? Reggie, your dad was, you know, the Reg Hayter news agency, and I think Dickie Bird tells me, John, that you work for the Reg Hayter news agency, very, very first job in cricket. So was it always going to be into this sort of the journal side of sport because of the old man?
No, it was a total accident. In fact, it was the last thing I wanted to do was to be a sports journalist. I had no ambition to do that at all. I went to university and studied drama and English, and I wanted to do theatre. Funnily enough, 1,000 years later, I'm doing quite a lot of that now. But and it went quite well. But I left after a year at the college because no college could hold me. I joined a pornographic Punch and Judy show, which was my big break, and that went well. And then that stopped because I turned up to start rehearsing for a new show, and the guy who ran it wasn't there. And I said, how long is he going to be? And they said 6 months, 3 with good behaviour, because he just got sent down for receiving stolen goods. Oh, so no. That was a signal for me to have a career change. So I plucked up the courage to ask my old man for a job. And ludicrously, he gave me one, making tea and sat and fetching sandwiches for people like John. And then I went out on a couple of jobs, and I couldn't actually think of any reason not to carry on. It was an absolute fluke. But then I stayed with my dad for a couple of years, 3 or 4 years. Then I started freelancing on my own, got a job with the Mail on Sunday in 1989 as the cricket writer. And that was where it all started to go wrong.
And you, John, you know, you started with the Reggie Hayter news agency, and you've been in it for, been following course, doing cricket for 40 years. Yeah, I think first of all, is there something wrong with you?
Well, I know. That was 1977. I was very keen on cricket. I used to sit at home and score the test matches ball by ball off TV and off the radio. And I sent some stuff to a guy called Bill Frindle, who was the bearded wonder. who used to be the scorer and statistician on the radio on Test Match Special. And surprisingly, he wrote back to me and said, yeah, I can come and help him. I used to go to his house up in North London. I went to the Oval Test Match of 1977 and phoned over the score, just generally helped out and observed and that sort of stuff. And I said to him, how about I become a sports journalist, which was something I'd always liked the sound of, but never really thought I'd get the chance to do. And he said, well, why don't you speak to this guy called Red Tater, who was, you know, as I subsequently discovered, was sort of a kind of legendary figure in Fleet Street. And I went to see Reg. I had an interview, and he gave me a job, pretty much like Peter as a tea boy and messenger doing the post. But if you showed keen listen and a degree of aptitude, Reg would give you a chance. And within 6 months, I was writing stories for local newspapers and going to games and doing reports, a bit of radio here and there. And I was there for a good number of years until in 1986, I joined the Sun as initially a football reporter, and I was a rugby correspondent for a little bit, and then pretty much full-time cricket since about 1990.
In Reg 89, John 86, you're talking about times without mobile phones and Twitter and everything that goes with that. Must have been some good times and good tours on sort of late 80s, early 90s there. Must have been, Reg.
No, we had a terrible time, Harvey. Bloody torture, I tell you. We had to Barbados and Sydney and on 5-star luxury hotels and business class travel. And for a Sunday paper, only having to write once a week, which caused a bit of consternation among my colleagues for several years. No, it was backbreaking work, I tell you. I'm amazed I survived, frankly.
I think one of the things, actually, being a journalist is that, I mean, you as a player, Harmony, every time you have a poor game or an indifferent match, you're looking over your shoulder, you're worried you're going to be dropped, and who's going to take my place. But really, unless you absolutely screw up, as a journalist, as a cricket correspondent, you're never dropped. You know, I've never had to worry about being replaced by somebody or, you know, being dropped and then recalled. I just go to every game, home and away, without any questions being asked, really.
In the time, Reg, at the times of sort of that 90s time covering the England side, it was literally what John's saying there. If you had a bad game, you got dropped.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you didn't even have to have that bad a game either. just whether it was your turn or not. No, I mean, we had a fantastic time in those days. I mean, it's completely different, I imagine. I haven't been touring since my last tour was 2014, but I did 25 years. And well, the stories I could tell you, I should probably write a book, although very carefully, and delete some of the names.
How many phone calls would you have to have before you wrote that book?
Well, one. No, it just had to be an offer I couldn't understand, and the book would be written. Don't worry about it. But I think the critical difference probably now is that I felt we had much stronger and closer access to the players than they do now. I mean, we stayed at the same hotels. We were on the same flights, sometimes on the same coaches, in the same bars. And there wasn't the pressure in terms of social media. Mobile phones hadn't really been invented as far as I can remember. And so there was a much more relaxed atmosphere, particularly on tour, when you happened to bump into someone in a bar and you bought them a drink or they bought you a drink and you just behaved like two blokes in a bar having a drink. And sometimes, but, you know, perhaps not as you should have done, let's say. But you know, the atmosphere was much more relaxed. There wasn't this feeling that you had to be watching them all the time and reporting on them. There was time when you could actually just be mates. And it was a fantastic privilege, incredible, to be touring with the likes of Ian Botham and David Gower and Alan Lamb and Robin Smith and Phil Tufnell for all those years. My God, I mean, I'm quite surprised I managed to survive as long as I did in the company of Beefy, for instance, and also Tuffers, because, you know, they took no prisoners. And there are some stories that I could tell you about both of them that will get both of us into a lot of trouble, so I won't. But suffice to say, we just had a bit of a great time, to be fair. And it was it didn't feel like a job. It felt like a lottery win. And I was privileged to do it for as long as I did. And I'm sure John will also now tell you some stories about his life that he'd rather were hushed up.
I think you make a good point about, you know, sort of socialising and entertaining players. You know, 20, 30 years ago, the cricketers were well paid, but they weren't rich enough to say no to a free meal. And if a journalist could buy dinner for a couple of players or a nice round of drinks, put it on expenses, then the players would say thanks very much. Now, of course, money's pretty much an object. You know, if you're any sort of England cricketer, you're earning probably £1 million a year. So, you know, the attractor of a free bit of scoff with a mucky hack from the tabloid is less appealing, I guess. You know, so I think that's part of it. And I think the social media thing and the phones thing, I mean, is fundamentally changed everyone's behaviour, really. I mean, now everybody has a camera in their pocket. So it doesn't bother me or the journalists particularly, but the cricketers, they know if they go out and want to let their hair down, have a drink maybe, talk to a girl perhaps, there's always somebody lurking with a mobile phone, put a picture, put it on Twitter, Instagram, whatever it might be. And that is really inhibiting. And that means that they, even when they go out to socialise, they're not able fully to relax.
And I can concur with that as well, Reg, because I think the 2003, I think the World Cup in 2003 off the back of the Ashes trip, me and Huggy were in the 15-man squad. And I think we spent more time with the journalists than we did with our own teammates because we had no chance of playing. And 7 o'clock every night, we were out and, you know, we were enjoying each other's company. And like you said, no social media, no mobile phones or cameras and anything like that. And Reg, you mentioned some characters there, names that you've played with. England have had some, you know, they've had some good players over the course of that early parts of your sort of journalist careers. The characters that stand out that you think, you know what, you know, they made my job a lot more enjoyable, whether it was on the field or sometimes off the field.
Well, you know, I started with Botham. I mean, I was very lucky because my father was actually Botham's press agent for a long time in the 70s and 80s. So I knew Ian a little bit, not very well. But I did also play cricket with Angus Fraser for Stanmore in the Middlesex League a few times. So my debut, as it were, as a cricket writer coincided with Angus's debut in the England team in 89. So I had an in to the team, and through him I got to know other players, and I'd known Beefy a bit. So, Ian was, you know, what can I say? He was larger than life in all ways, on and off the field. And if you happen to come into his orbit socially, you know, buckle up, because it was always a hell of a ride. You never had a boring night with Ian Botham. Some of them you couldn't remember at all the next morning. Some of them you couldn't remember while they were going on. And some of them were catastrophic. There was carnage. You know, he laid waste to whole tracts of South Africa and Australia and West Indies in his time. And, you know, I just was along for the ride. It was incredible, some of the stuff. And what always amazed me was that he was then able to get up the next day and run in and bowl and you know, hit the ball. Sometimes, as everyone remembers, forgot to take his bat with him to the middle after a big session the night before. And, you know, you just felt you were teetering on the brink of something all the time with Beef. You know, you had to have resolve. You had to have strength of character to keep up with him. And sometimes, you know, you look to him in awe the next day and thought, how I can barely breathe today. And he is running up and bowling in 90-degree hat. He's a superhuman. And I'm convinced he had an extra liver when he was born, and an extra heart and an extra pair of lungs, because frankly, to get through what he did in that period of time and not, you know, be dead by 40 was a miracle. And I hope he donates his body to medical science when he finally goes, because he'll unlock a lot of mysteries for us, I can tell you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I mean, there's a couple of guys on your team at TalkSport who didn't mind a good time and a night out. You know, Goffey and Mark Butcher. I remember one occasion in the Sandton Sun Hotel in Sandton, just on the outskirts of Johannesburg, which got a big sort of atrium, so you can see up all the floors and the corridors, you know, 25 floors up. And the journalists were having a bit of a sing-song, actually. And in fact, the next day, the team manager was sort of told off by some fans, your player's an absolute disgrace, and actually it turned out to be the journalist. And of course, the noise would echo upwards through this atrium of the hotel. And at about 3:45 in the morning, the character came down clutching a glass of red wine in his bathrobe. And it was Butch, Mark Butcher, who said, right, what's the next song, lad? You know, he would enjoy a good time. And of course, Goffey at... I'm sure he's told plenty of stories against himself, but Goffey was occasionally thirsty and always up for a good laugh. I remember one occasion in Guyana, the Pegasus Hotel in Georgetown, Guyana. He a couple of guys were giving him a bit of a hard time, and I think they were going to try and grab his phone. This is in the early days of phone, and he said, "Well, if you do that again, I'll."
I was there.
Yeah. I mean, I think they pushed him in the end, didn't they?
Pushed him in the swimming pool. Yeah,
pushed him in the swimming pool, and he went down all guns blazing, swinging, and all the rest of it. He didn't see the funny side of that, but I'm sure in the end of the evening they all shook hands and made up.
No, he did. I remember that. I remember that very, very well. It was, I think it was the 04 trip for the One Days. There's a couple of Army decided that throwing people in the pool, and Goffey made his usual, you know, big Churchillian comment, anybody pushes me in, I'm going to deck them. And I think as they pushed him in, they fell in as well. So he just amberly swam over to them and just let one go, bang, smacked one straight on the end of the nose. And I think me and Fred were straight in to try and pull him off. And all of a sudden, you know, the Yorkshireman's going like you'd not believe. He's like a Tasmanian devil in water. So you mentioned characters, and Reggie mentioned Beefy. But you wrote Andrew Flintoff's column for The Sun for quite a while. That must have been an experience, because that was during times of, you know, of the sort of crossover of social media and mobile phones coming into the world.
Yeah, we had Freddie for probably 10 years, I would think, and occasions when the most difficult part of the job was finding him or waking him up, you know. I remember one occasion, I think you'll know better than me, Harmy, but I don't think his room was the tidiest, was it?
No, it wasn't. We were never the tidiest.
I seem to remember, you know, half-eaten pizzas and bottles of Coke sort of scattered around the place, but...
They were probably mine. That's what you're seeing now, looking at him.
And
looking
you and him more had interconnecting rooms, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. We had interconnecting rooms because, you know, I was, as Reggie will vouch for, because Reggie came in and did the Mail on Sunday piece for me quite a few times, and Fred would come in the middle of the afternoon just, you know, announcing that he was in. And it was I needed somebody to be around me, and Freddie was scared of the dark. So we decided, right, we'll get interconnecting rooms. We'll leave a door open, my bathroom light on, and we'll be sorted, because we wanted a room there. But, you know, the characters that were going around at that time and the tours that we're going on during that spell were unbelievable. And, you know, I think, like you said, journalists and players were close, and the close bond. Do you think that helped? Do you think that helped you guys do your job? And do you think sometimes, indirectly, the players might not admit it, but it was actually good for the players to have the journalists, you know, quite close by because of something in common on an away trip?
Yeah, I think what I'd say now is that all press interaction with the team is sort of man-managed. I mean, it's all press conferences, England players wearing the sponsor's hat or the logo, often a sort of a backdrop behind them with the sponsor's name on. And in fairness, the guy who is in charge of that now, Danny Rubin, does an absolutely brilliant job. He couldn't be more helpful. He's fantastic. But the days of just sort of wandering up to a player, maybe in the lobby or having a coffee, have almost gone. I mean, There was time. You could stuff up and ask, you know, what do you reckon? You know, who's going to play tomorrow? Who might be left out? And these days, they tend to say, oh, have you spoken to Danny? Okay, we've cleared it with Danny. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, you could just have a chat with somebody. And I think another aspect is that tours now are so condensed. And even now, you know, even in the pressure around and there's no COVID, within a week or two, maybe have one practice match, maximum two, and then straight into the international games, the test matches and so on. Whereas I've been, and Reggie Hayter likewise, I've been on tours of Australia where it's 6 or 7 weeks before they play the first test. And in that period of time, you're hopping around the country, lots of time to talk to people, maybe the guys who aren't actually in the 11 of the warm-up games, happy to come out and have a drink and a night out. So I think press relations are pretty good now, and that's largely due to Danny Rubin. I think they're a nice bunch of blokes, as it happens, really good guys, but it isn't quite the same sort of a social interaction as there was 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I remember some of my best work was done in the bar, frankly. Mm. And what you always did was when you did speak to someone in the bar, and they might, you know, there was a lot of pressure on these guys, even though it wasn't the pressure there is now. They were playing for their futures and it was their careers and they, you know, they were up against excellent players as well, all in the same boat. So there was no, initially there was no Barmy Army either. So they had no contact with, you know, ordinary people, if you like, people who were wanted to be supportive of them. Families very rarely came out. So they were in their own company a lot, which is good in some ways and bad in others. So you occasionally you became a bit of an agony uncle or a bit of a confidant as well. You know, someone would want to go out for a drink because they'd had a tough day in the field. They got gnawed or they'd been hit around the park. And they didn't necessarily want to cry on the shoulders of their teammates. So sometimes you found yourself in a situation with a player in a bar when they would actually be pouring their heart out to you because it was someone, they were reaching out and they needed a bit of support. And you respected that always. And, you know, as I say, some of my best work was done in the bar. But always when you had a conversation with someone in the bar, it was always off the record. And then you would go back to the player the next day if you felt there was something that could develop into a story and say, do you remember what we were talking about last night? Can we put that in the paper? How can we put that in the paper? You would talk to players and you know, it would be a partnership between you and the players. Not all the time. Sometimes you just had to be a critic. Sometimes you had to say that he played a terrible shot or he bowled awfully badly or whatever. You had to be true to what you were writing about. But at the same time, because you had that closeness with people, you had an empathy with them and you could tell their side of the story sometimes. If there was a story to be told, you knew what their side of it was. That put you in a privileged position. And sometimes it was good and sometimes it was tricky. I mean, I remember going on tour to Australia, the tour when Phil Tufnell, who I've written a couple of books with and I'm currently writing another one now for my sins, ended up in a psychiatrist's chair in Perth. And I got to Adelaide after a long flight and I got into my room and the first thing that happened was the phone rang and it was Phil. And he said, I need to see you now. Come down to the bar. And I went to the bar and there was Phil and there was Graham Thorpe. And Phil told me about everything that had happened about him trashing his room. He was terribly upset. He was going through psychological trauma and he ended up in a psychiatric observation, which he then sort of checked himself out of. And he was about to be sent home from the tour. And that was very early on in the tour. And I had to keep that information for the whole of the tour with everything else that had happened. And of course I was going to do that because he was talking to me as a mate. But I remember towards the end of the tour, people had heard a few things and a few rumours about what had happened. I think, John, you might have been close to it as well, physically.
I was very close to it. I was in the room opposite, across the corridor.
Exactly. So you are in that position where, you know, you have to look after the players. And it wasn't all one. It was two-way traffic all the time, I felt. Occasionally, I felt you were put in a position where it was tough to do your job in that regard because you had to be, you know, the stuff I didn't tell my newspaper was far more than the stuff I told my newspaper. But I told them enough for them to continue to employ me for 25 years. So it worked both ways.
You've been listening to part one of a conversation between the former England bowler Steve Harmison, the sons John Etheridge, and the former Mail on Sunday cricket correspondent Peter Hayter. If you missed any of the show or wish to catch up, you can listen again to the podcast available on the Following On feed, now available on the free TalkSport app. We'll be back tomorrow with the second part of this conversation as Harmy, John Etheridge and Peter Hayter go on the road again.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.